Hi, Patrick Cox here.
Stretching, working those abs, and of course seeking spiritual enlightenment here at the World in Words Yoga Studio.
Don't worry, I don't have an exercise routine for you, but we will consider the word yoga, a word as flexible as its greatest practitioners. Also, the French book that invented a kid's language turns 50, and more Wikipedia this week, which foreign language articles to trust.
As a free man, I take pride in the word, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
It's embarrassing when Europeans come over here. They all speak English, and then we go over to Europe, and all we can say is merci beaucoup.
Yuck shamash.
And bye-bye, Borat. Borat needs to spend more time working on Kazakh Wikipedia, not real Kazakh, which we'll hear a little bit more about later in this podcast, but, you know, Borat Kazakh. So, tearfully, I bid you farewell. The World is co-produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. The Big Show is broadcast on more than 250 public radio stations around the United States. Listen online at theworld.org. That's also where you can check out all of our other podcasts. We're also on Facebook. There's a World in Words Facebook group. Please join it. That's the best place to ask follow-up questions about things you've heard in the podcast, and also to tell me when I've messed up. The other place to get a hold of me is email. The address is language@pri.org. Today, yoga, Le Petit Nicolas, and part two of Foreign Wikipedias. Let's start with Le Petit Nicolas. This is a series of books hugely beloved by French kids. Actually, not just French kids, but in France, Petit Nicolas is a nationally recognizable figure. So much so that when political commentators call French President Nicolas Sarkozy Petit Nicolas, Sarkozy's not a tall man, when they call him that, pretty much everyone gets the reference. Well, Le Petit Nicolas has just turned 50, and here's Anita Ilash in Paris.
Visitors to this exhibit in Paris about the Petit Nicolas stories are obviously having a good time. They're cracking up at the pranks of this 8-year-old French schoolboy in short pants and a tie.
C'est juste un petit Nicolas.
This 6-year-old is doubled over, looking at an illustration in which Nicolas defies his father by playing the same record over and over again. This woman in her late 50s loves the puns and the innocent trouble Nicolas gets into with his teachers.
C'est sympa. C'est pas tout à fait notre époque, mais c'est un petit peu...
She says the stories are from a different era, but to her, they're timeless and universal. In France, Le Petit Nicolas isn't just a series of children's books. It's considered a literary classic. It's especially loved because Nicolas speaks like a child, but mocks the adults with the clarity of a sage. Aymar Duchatenay curated the Paris exhibit.
Goscinny a inventé un langage de gosse. Essayer, c'est extrêmement difficile sans que ça ait l'air artificiel.
The author, René Goscinny, invented the language of a kid, something that's very hard to do without sounding artificial, and it is an extraordinary form of poetry. Nicolas also has a completely off-the-wall, naive view of his parents, so he undresses the adults. Something as simple as every time mother is upset, she runs to the kitchen to cry.
Petit Nicolas' appeal goes far beyond France. He's number one in places like Germany and Turkey, but he's never really caught on in the U.S. Jeff Ryder is a professor of Romance languages and director of the Wesleyan University Study Abroad program in Paris. He says he tried reading the books to his own kids.
They fell asleep.
Ryder says Americans don't get the Petit Nicolas books because so many of the jokes are based on French cultural values. Things like the authoritarian teacher, who Nicolas loves to mock by making faces behind his back.
You can have images of people slipping on banana peels, and the more dignified the person, the funnier that is. And I think making faces behind a teacher's back is funnier in France than it is in the United States, precisely because the teacher has more authority in the French school system and so on.
Petit Nicolas' birthday celebrations will go on all year in France. The icing on the cake, the first movie based on the stories, is coming out this fall. For The World, I'm Anita Ilash in Paris.
Now for Eating Sideways, the segment where we highlight a non-English word or phrase that doesn't easily translate into English. Once in every while, I throw in a word that actually does exist in English, but no attempt has been made to translate it from the original language. That's the case this week with the word yoga, which comes from Sanskrit via Hindi. It means, in Hindi, union or joining. That means something quite concrete. Whereas in English, the meaning seems much more elusive. It seems to mean very different things to different people. Is it a form of exercise? Is it a religious ritual? Is it a combination of the two, a physical practice that leads to spiritual enlightenment? And just thinking back to the original meaning, who is the union of yoga with? With oneself? With other practitioners? With a higher being? There's a new documentary out that poses some of these questions and offers a few possible answers. The Big Show's Lisa Mullins talked to the movie's director and a guy who I suppose you might call the protagonist. Before we get to them, here's a bit from the film.
Why do I do yoga?
It's a great workout. Amazing physical exercise and workout.
It gives you a spiritual experience. You work hard, you sweat.
It really engages the totality of who I am as a human being.
It's empowerment. This is a strong practice. And the only thing that will ever transform you is practice.
Filmmaker Kate Churchill didn't need convincing. She'd been a yoga devotee for 7 years. Journalist Nick Rosen, on the other hand, was a yoga skeptic, and therein lay the seed that grew into the movie. The documentary is called Enlighten Up. It follows Nick Rosen's six-month investigation of yoga under the watchful camera eye of Kate Churchill. She says the idea struck her as a natural for the movie.
If we took someone who'd never done yoga and we could go anywhere in the world and have a period of time to do it, what could happen? And I really thought that there would be something quite profound. I was convinced of it.
A lot of pressure, Nick, to do something quite profound.
Yeah, there was a certain amount of pressure. I mean, when Kate asked me to do this, it was sort of like, how could I say no? We're going around the world. We're going to make a film about yoga, and you might just be transformed in the process. Even without the transformation, it sounded like a really fun thing to do. So I couldn't say no.
Okay, so you met, and by the way, had you ever done yoga before?
I had done yoga maybe a couple times, but certainly no serious practice before. I knew barely, very little about it.
Well, it's interesting to watch how various people, especially here in the United States and then in India, personalize yoga. And I wonder, Kate, if you can tell us about a few stops along the way as you and Nick made your way finally to India. And actually, you know, one of the stellar characters, and I mean characters here in the U.S., who's practicing his own version of yoga, is the wrestler Diamond Dallas Page. He promotes something called Yoga for Regular Guys. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. We met Diamond Dallas Page in Los Angeles, and Dallas was a find of Nick's. He was bound and determined to go meet DDP, as he's called. It was very different from all other yoga classes that we had walked into. But Nick really was quite excited about meeting Dallas.
I can see why, Nick. Let's hear Diamond Dallas's yoga philosophy.
To sit around, the humming and the chanting, that's not what Yoga for Regular Guys is. Ours is about the workout, you know, and sweating your ass off. When you get to India and you got some guy doing I want you to walk up and blast him with the chair to say, hey, that's what they do in Yoga for Regular Guys.
Where do the girls come into this thing?
Well, for me, to grab the guys, there's got to be an element. And where yoga opens with namaste, mine's more about TNA.
Nick, what did that mean to you?
Well, Yoga for Regular Guys was about as far from the whole sanctimonious spiritual yoga scene that you could get. But it also, it wasn't perhaps as far as it seems. I mean, every aspect of Western yoga, and by that I mean the sort of stretching with a spiritual component to it, really was very much about physicality and physical fitness and people working on their bodies. And, you know, there's a whole very sort of materialistic vain quality to yoga that people try to sort of talk around and act like it's a spiritual pursuit. But really, if it wasn't good for their abs, then would they really be doing it? I don't know. Yoga for Regular Guys really precipitated the materialistic quality of yoga.
So right there, Diamond Dallas Page was kind of the extreme of what you found here in the United States. I mean, not entirely, and Kate, maybe you can speak to this, but there is a great emphasis on what yoga does physically in making you fit.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the attraction for Westerners is certainly physical, first and foremost, and many teachers will agree to that. We were told by a number of different teachers that they felt the spiritual studies came second, and that once people start doing a physical practice, they would become more curious.
All right. And then you guys eventually get to India, and one of the things you're greeted by is this.
And why do you guys do laughter yoga?
I like it very much.
I'm feeling happy.
Whole life is cheerful now. And very active.
Many Indians do yoga. Mm-hmm. But what we have done in Laughter Club is we combine laughing exercises with yoga breathing and some stretching exercises. That makes it a laughter yoga.
So we had gone to Mumbai, and we had met Dr. Madan Kataria, who is known as the international guru of giggling. The idea is that if you raise your spirits, then you can become spiritual. And through laughter, you can open yourself up. And so they incorporate laughter with certain stretches and breathing. And it's their form of yoga that he's created.
Throughout, we were looking at the conflict, the apparent conflict between the physicality of yoga and the spirituality of yoga as practiced in the West, because they seem like very different themes. And I think that ultimately, you can go to India to explore the spiritual side probably more effectively, but to have a yoga practice that is fulfilling on a physical and a mental level, I don't think you need to go to India. And I don't think it really matters what yoga style that you practice. You know, when I do practice yoga these days, which isn't very often, you know, I go to a yoga class where right in the middle of it, they lapse into very transparently physical things like crunches and sit-ups. It's basically an ab workout in the middle of the yoga class. And I like it, you know. And then at the end of the class, they sort of end it with a Sanskrit blessing. So whether these things go together, I think our exploration showed that, you know, the phenomenon of physical and spiritual together is a very modern thing. But that doesn't matter. I think it's okay. It still works great.
All right. The film is called Enlighten Up. Kate Churchill, filmmaker, Nick Rosen, journeyman, I guess, as you probably both were. Thank you. Very nice to talk to you.
It's a pleasure to speak with you, Lisa.
Now, I imagine that Enlighten Up will do very well with the yoga crowd. But I have to say that even for someone like me, who doesn't practice yoga and who's almost completely ignorant of yoga culture, it's still really worth seeing. It's a great window on a bunch of other people's worlds. Now, onto something I do practice, which is using an encyclopedia, in this case, the online encyclopedia Wikipedia. On last week's podcast, I played the first half of an interview I did with Wikipedia historian Andrew Lee. He's got a new book out called The Wikipedia Revolution, How a Bunch of Nobodies Created the World's Greatest Encyclopedia. So last week, we talked about the difference between some of the big Wikipedias, the ones with the most content, English, German, Japanese. We also talked about how Wikipedia is actually influencing the development of certain languages, Arabic being a case in point. And we also talked about the subject of trust, when and how to trust a Wikipedia entry. Remember, the entries, the articles, they're written and re-edited by an army of volunteers, people like you and me. So for the second part of our interview, we're going to push this subject of trust a little bit further. When we left off, we were talking about China, where the government sometimes allows people to read Wikipedia online, and sometimes it doesn't. Right now, the Chinese government blocks just a few Wikipedia articles, things on Tibet, the Tiananmen Square protest, those kinds of things. I asked Andrew Lee whether Chinese officials ever write and edit their own Wikipedia articles as a way of controlling what people learn about certain episodes in history and politics. Here's what he said.
So far, there's no evidence that there's any intentional manipulation by government in Wikipedia's entries on these issues, for China at least. But there have been examples of, even in the United States, of people within government agencies trying to edit some articles. So there's a project called Wikiscanner that takes a look at all the anonymous edits in Wikipedia and tries to trace back to at least what organization they're with. And you'd be surprised how many government agencies, corporations, other folks with a conflict of interest are editing articles for which they probably shouldn't be editing because of the problem of being able to edit neutrally about these topics.
What happens then at that stage if you've got the smoking gun of a government agency or what have you? How do you alert the reader?
In the past, there have been some blocks. So in English language Wikipedia, there had been some edits to certain politicians' webpage from inside the office of the U.S. Congress. So at certain points, those editors have been blocked because they've been adding in biased information on those folks. You don't exactly know who these folks are, but probably editing an article about a politician from inside the offices of the politician is probably not a good practice. So those folks have been blocked from time to time for short amounts of time. But I think the Wikiscanner project is quite an interesting one. It's an example of sunlight being the best disinfectant. You try to shine as much light on the information about who's editing what articles, and hopefully public shame will be good enough to prevent this from happening in the future.
Right, right. So say I am a speaker of a particular language that does not have a Wikipedia. Okay, I interviewed somebody last week who speaks the Berik language, which is a minority language in Indonesia. And I doubt very much, because I've spoken by very few people, I doubt very much whether they have a Wikipedia. How would I go about establishing one?
In the past, if you had just some interest in doing it, they would try to start it up for you. These days, I think the threshold is, you need a few people to maintain it. There's nothing lonelier than being the only person on a wiki, although there are certain languages for which there are only one or two contributors to it. There is a language committee that you can submit the request to start up a language, and they want to make sure it, in fact, is a language, which is not always the case. And it doesn't always go by the UN standards or the ISO standards of what a language is, because there are actually some flaws in the ISO, or International Standards Organization, definition of what a language is. So you notice that Wikipedia's list of languages doesn't quite match what you would find for the ISO codes that you see on the internet. But there is a language committee, and they try to evaluate the merits and whether there's enough people to start it, and they'll launch it if there's enough interest.
And are there sometimes people who oppose the establishment of a language? I'm thinking of, maybe a language that is associated with a separatist movement within a country, or some disagreement over the name of a language, such as Moldovan, where people are split as to whether it should be, in fact, referred to as Romanian.
Right, right. I mean, one of the perennial problems is the establishment of the Montenegrin language. And there really is no Montenegrin language, from what I understand. My friend who's Serbian says that, Montenegrin is not really a distinct language. It's Serbian with some variants, but that's about it. To start up a whole new Wikipedia just on the Montenegrin language is more of a political statement than it is a linguistic statement. And that's been a sore point in the community, that there's a few folks who want to keep trying to start up the Montenegrin language and accuse the Wikipedia community of being biased against the politics of Montenegro because they won't allow this to start up. So there are definitely political battles within the community when it comes to language.
And how do they actually get resolved? Is the language committee's decision final?
It is final, but in the Wikipedia spirit, they obviously try to get as much public comment as possible. They look at the evidence in terms of what's the consensus. They ask speakers of a certain language, what are the merits of this? And they also look for context in terms of whether other universities or academies have recognized that language as being a distinct language. In the case of Montenegrin, it hasn't risen above a certain threshold to make that a distinct Wikipedia.
I'd like to talk about money just for a little bit. And this notorious episode, which you refer to as the Spanish Wikipedia fork, where, right, as far as I understand it, an attempt was made to create a profit-making version of Wikipedia in Spanish, if I got that right?
Well, it wasn't even that. It was even less significant than that. It was just a mailing list discussion saying, just musing about the idea perhaps someday of putting advertising in Wikipedia to at least raise some funds to meet the operating costs or to pay a certain person to help maintain Wikipedia. And just the whisper of that idea of all these people who had been contributing to Wikipedia under a free license to give knowledge to the world for free, of someone putting an ad on this and making money was so repellent to a certain portion of the Spanish Wikipedia community that even though people apologized on the list saying, oh, no, this is just, we're just musing, this is not a plan, we're not going to do it, it was so problematic for certain folks, they decided to abandon the community. And because the content is free, they copied all the content of Wikipedia and started a side competing project called Encyclopedia Libre. And that became the dominant Spanish user-contributed encyclopedia for over a year because the people who were upset at Wikipedia convinced all the Spanish Wikipedians to abandon Spanish Wikipedia, and Encyclopedia Libre became the vibrant, growing community for a long time. Until Wikipedia English and all the other Wikipedias became popular, then Spanish speakers went to Wikipedia and started populating that community with a new set of folks. And eventually, the Spanish Wikipedia, Encyclopedia Libre, came to a peace agreement in that sense. And Spanish Wikipedia became the growing and large encyclopedia. But that was a very interesting lesson in the free culture, is that even that little mention of advertising turned off an entire sector of the population in Wikipedia, to the point where now the idea of advertising Wikipedia is almost a taboo subject because of that episode early on in Wikipedia's history.
That's very interesting. And it also raises the question of how much is the Wikimedia Foundation, which oversees Wikipedia, how much control it has over the foreign language Wikipedias.
Right. And this is a big question, is because originally when the Wikipedia projects or the Wikimedia projects as a greater family of projects were all community run, and the Wikimedia Foundation just ran the servers and raised enough money to keep the infrastructure going. Now the Wikimedia Foundation is a much larger entity with 24 employees, $6 million budget, fundraisers, professional folks in these areas. Will more of these community functions start being handed over to paid employees? And what does that mean for the community? It's still an unknown whether there will be this, what they call the jealousy and altruism factor. Like some people are doing it for money and some people are doing it on a volunteer basis.
Where do you see some of the, you know, to look into the future a little bit, do you see some of the foreign language Wikipedias taking a direction that really is very different from the English language Wikipedia?
Well, I think the Chinese Wikipedia example is the most prominent one, where the Chinese language has a slight problem in that it has two different writing systems. One is called traditional and one is simplified. The simplified one has been pushed since the 1950s from the PRC, or People's Republic of China. And this writing system now is the most dominant one, even though it's the newer one. And originally in Wikipedia's history in the Chinese community, some articles were written in simplified, some were in traditional, and it was kind of a mishmash of the two. And what happened was that programmers in the Chinese community saw this as a problem, and they just created the software to solve this problem, you know, within a matter of weeks. And this system has been so successful in the Chinese Wikipedia, being able to map between simplified and traditional writing systems, it's been brought to other languages for which writing systems have been a problem. So probably the most famous one is the Kazakh language has three different writing systems, which makes it even more challenging. So they have Latin script, Cyrillic script, and right-to-left Arabic script. So you can actually choose among these three different types of writing systems in the Kazakh language Wikipedia, which is quite a fascinating thing because Kazakh is a prominent language, but it might not rise to the level where a commercial company would spend all the time to create this type of software. So this is an example where the free software movement has really been beneficial to these languages for which the market forces would not really prompt a commercial company to spend all that money to create a solution.
And what about in terms of the content of some of the foreign language Wikipedias? Do you see some that are moving in wildly different directions?
I think one of the challenges right now is that there are some Wikipedias for which the core belief in the neutral point of view has been tough to maintain. We've seen that in languages like English, where you have a wide diversity of different types of folks. And even in German language, where you have, you know, Swiss and Austrian and German, you have enough diversity of viewpoints to make this neutral point of view work. But in some language cultures, you do not have a wide diversity of views, right? So the language culture is pretty much rooted in a very ideological culture as well. In those cases, there have been examples of languages for which you read the articles and the neutral point of view is not being adhered to, and there's actually very nationalistic feelings in the articles. And it's not clear that it can be solved anytime soon because it's a systemic problem, because the language speakers tend to be of a certain political stripe or ideological stripe. And it may be that this neutral point of view ideal that Wikipedia has really only is effective in the larger languages where you have a wide variety of people from different intellectual backgrounds, different political backgrounds, and different world experiences. And in fact, once you get down to, you know, the second 20 languages in Wikipedia, neutral point of view just breaks down very quickly.
Wow. Which languages should I be looking
for? Well, it's a good question. I mean, there's a lot of languages in the second 20 languages for which the number of articles is fairly small, and that if you look at articles about war crimes or about territorial disputes or about political parties and dissidents, you're going to find very biased articles. And unless you have folks who are in those language groups that are willing to take the other viewpoints and more controversial stances, the kind of nationalistic fervor will take hold in those Wikipedias.
Andrew Lee, author of a book just out called The Wikipedia Revolution. So as you heard, Andrew was reluctant to single out any particular foreign language Wikipedia as biased or nationalistic, but he did say you could start to find that attitude among the second 20 Wikipedias. That is, the Wikipedias in languages whose popularity in terms of articles written ranks them between number 21 and number 40. So I'm going to name a few of those languages. Not point the finger necessarily, just name them. Greek, Indonesian, Hungarian, Hebrew, Serbian, Arabic, Persian. It's not that the Wikipedia entries in these languages, many others too, it's not that they're all horribly biased. It's just that maybe occasionally not every entry will be as, let's say, argued over and edited as the English language version or the German version. Of course, further down the popularity list, things get much sketchier. And interestingly, there are some really widely spoken languages down near the bottom of the list that have just a few hundred articles in their Wikipedias. Languages like Punjabi, Gujarati, and Pashto, which between the three of them are spoken by more than 180 million people. So, still a lot of room for wiki expansion. One last thing, if you want to hear some more of Andrew Lee, as I mentioned before, the first part of the interview I did with him is in The World in Words number 47. There's also a completely different interview he did with the Big Show's tech correspondent, Clark Boyd. For more on that and Clark's technology podcast, go to theworld.org/technology. Well, it's time to say bye-bye now. I've got lots of great material planned for the next couple of weeks. I don't want to promise anything for next week because sometimes breaking news happens and plays havoc with the planning. But just perhaps next week, and if not then, the podcast and the week after, I've got a really, really nice set of stories on the Korean language. Talk to you again next week.